we're the next generation of voters in this country. We're the next generation of leaders. We are the next generation. We are what America will be.
That's Ramon Contreras. The 19-year-old New Yorker is part of the Road to Change bus tour organized by the students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Their goal? Get young people involved and get them to vote.
Something that we've been getting a lot is that we're making voting cool again. We're making politics cool again.
The bus tour is stopping in 75 cities in more than 20 states. Ramon spoke to us from one of the stops in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
We have a high amount of young people coming out to our rallies. We've been interacting with thousands of young people. And in due time, we'll see what this democracy is really made of.
For the second half of the show, we'll be focusing on a key demographic this November. Young voters like Ramon. Ramon and the Road to Change are facing an uphill battle. Young people tend not to vote in large numbers, especially in midterm elections. And because they don't vote, the parties often ignore them. And because they ignore them, young people don't vote. It's your classic political chicken and egg problem.
There has been so much activism among teenagers and very young people who are leading, for example, movements around gun violence and gun safety.
That's Kay Kawashima Ginsburg, director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, which is part of the Jonathan M. Tisch College of Civic Life at Tufts.
They're participating in marches and protests. There are registration drive everywhere. This generation, especially the late teens and, you know, people that are just turning 18 and 19, have been exposed to unprecedented amount of outreach for the youngest of the voters. We haven't really seen this level of attention to teenagers and very young new voters in recent memories, especially during midterm.
So how does this compare to previous years?
So in 2008, two-thirds, really full two-thirds of young people voted for President Obama, and that support was really unparalleled compared to any other year we've seen. However, the groups like white young male had shifted from about two-thirds, just as much as any other group, including women and white women supporting President Obama, to now in 2016, less than half voting for Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. So that group in particular, at least with the data we have, really changed their minds about who they're supporting.
What did you learn about the women who voted for Obama and what they looked like in 2016 and non-white voters and how they broke out?
You know, white women have actually been supportive of the Democratic presidential candidate this whole time. In some ways, there are, of course, differences by racial groups. White women are far less likely to support a Democratic candidate in 2016. It became, I think, less than half, while the women of color were, by decisive margin, supporting Hillary Clinton. In 2008, that sort of difference wasn't as obvious. There were much more unified support behind President Obama than the Democratic candidate compared to what it is today, where a lot of young people are really divided by their demographic groups, where they live, and how much education they have. And those things seem to really divide who they think can really support their views and who they think they have their backs.
Let's go back in time a little bit. Before 2008, was it always the case that younger voters gave their support overwhelmingly to the Democratic candidate?
Oh, no, it's not at all true. This is really a recent trend where young people have leaned decisively to a Democratic candidate. Back in the 80s or even early 90s, young people pretty much evenly divided in terms of the choice of the candidate. And not only that, most young people are far more moderate than they are today.
So what do we know about people as they age through life and the votes that they cast when they are 18 and the party that they cast it for to when they turn 30 to when they turn 40 and 50 and beyond? I had heard the theory that your very first votes that you cast and the party that you cast them for and the environment you were living in at that moment is so formative that it does stay with you throughout your life. People obviously change, and that doesn't mean everybody stays this way, but that a generation could continue to vote for a party if they had supported that party when they were younger.
And I think I would even say, you know, nowadays, because young people are not really committing to one or the other party in large number, it's really about the story they tell about their first election and the impact they feel they had. So already in 2008, young people were starting to really register as unaffiliated or independent voters. But if you speak to many older millennials today, they remember that 2008 election as a transformative one. It really changed the way they thought about themselves as somebody that can have a direct impact by working on political cause. That memory, I think, stays with them. So if that candidate or party continues to represent that ideal or that feeling that they were able to have by engaging with that particular party, I think parties can be really successful in maintaining the support from that voter that voted for the first time and may stay with you. But if the voters can change their perception about what that party represents or what kind of candidates are running from that party, I think that support may not necessarily stay. And this is probably why we saw such a big swing in some subgroups of young people between 2008 and 2016.
One incredible fact Kay told me, more 18 to 24-year-olds have registered to vote so far this year, 3 months ahead of this year's midterms, than they did through November of 2016. What does that tell us? Well, it's a sign that younger voters are seriously engaged in this election. That doesn't normally happen in midterm years. But as we all know, registering's only one step. The bigger and more important question, will they come out and actually vote? We asked you young people out there.
Hi, this is Eric from Seattle.
My name is Emily from Alameda.
This is Dakota from Tampa, Florida.
Edwin from Dallas. I'm 23 years old.
My name's Andre and I'm calling from Lakeland, Florida.
Daniel Dudley from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm 28 years old and I've voted every year for the last 10.
I'm 18 years old and I've never been more involved in politics.
I will be voting in November for the very first time in midterm elections.
I'm 30 years old, and I will definitely be voting because men and women have died so that I could.
I wasn't going to be voting just because there's such a political circus.
I'm pro-gun, pro-women's rights, and pro-workers' rights, but sadly, those things don't go together down here.
I've made sure I'll get my mail-in ballot so I can vote.
Kind of becoming pretty concerned about where the left is going and the Democrats. I'm going to be re-electing Donald Trump.
My grandfather, a World War II veteran, always said, if you don't vote, you don't have any right to complain.
I think that a key thing that we've seen over the last few decades is that there's been an increasing sort of age polarization in the electorate.
Sean McElwee is the co-founder of Data for Progress, and he thinks a lot about what motivates young people to vote for progressive candidates.
If you actually go back, you know, 20, 30 years, there was actually stories in the New York Times in the midterms about Reagan and how if, you know, young people didn't turn out, it could be bad for Republicans. And I think people don't realize the just dramatic age polarization that we've seen since, you know, 2008 is a relatively new development. And what that means is that the Democratic Party now has a greater incentive to invest in youth turnout than parties have had in the past.
There's this myth that exists, and it doesn't just exist on the right, but it's this quote that is misattributed to Winston Churchill, which says, if you are young and conservative, you have no heart, and if you are old and liberal, you have no brain.
And that's Kristen Soltis Anderson, co-founder of Echelon Insights and author of The Selfie Vote. She's a conservative and says the GOP needs to change its thinking when it comes to attracting young voters.
The idea that, well, everyone starts off progressive when they're young and then becomes conservative when they get older. And what that misses is that's actually just the baby boomers. That is what happened to the baby boomers. Or that doesn't mean that that's what's happened to everyone. And so if you look, you don't actually have to go back that far to find an election where young people and their grandparents were breaking about the same. And that's the 2000 election. If you look at the exit polls there, young people broke for Al Gore by a very slim margin, and so did senior citizens. So this new polarization along the age axis is new. It began slightly before Barack Obama's presidency. You really begin to see signs of it popping up in the 2006 midterms. But it's the sort of thing where Republicans initially thought, well, it's okay that young people are voting for Democrats, because it's just Obama, they'll come back to our side, and that hasn't happened.
Krista, do you then worry, given the polarization that we're seeing along age groups and the ways in which younger voters are giving their votes, the share that they're giving to Democrats, and that Republicans don't seem to be reaching out to these voters, that this is a generation lost to Republicans, like, forever?
This has been a fear of mine for a while, and it is a fear that feels like it's coming through more and more every day. But at the same time, Republicans feel quite pleased with where they're sitting right now. Even as that sort of micro nightmare comes to fruition, Republicans have control of the White House. They have control of both chambers of Congress. They are now appointing a justice to the Supreme Court that will tip the balance in a more conservative direction. So for someone like me who is conservative, you know, I wonder, what will the audience be for conservatism among my generation when we are in our 50s or 60s? And I don't know that the work is being done by the right side of the aisle to make the case to this generation. Instead, it's just, well, they don't really vote that much, and they'll all become conservative as they get older. And that's just, I think, a flawed way to approach it. If you take a look at the oldest members of the millennial generation, those who are kind of in their mid-30s, back in 2008, or perhaps even in 2004, the very first time that many millennials could vote in a presidential election, you know, they were breaking for the Democrats, and you had this assumption, again, that they would move to the right as they got older. And yet, these voters are now in their mid-30s, and they have shown no sign of moving back toward the Republican Party. If anything, they are among the most progressive. In fact, it's some of the younger folks who I think have less of an allegiance to a particular party. They may lean more progressive on many issues, but sort of say a little bit of a plague o' both their houses, and consider themselves independent. I think that's among the few opportunities that Republicans have left, is reaching out to these young, very young voters who have not yet picked a party, who don't really love either party, making the case that the GOP is perhaps not what they are being told it is, would be an important first step to kind of opening that door and trying to secure the Republican Party's long-term future.
So do your friends in the Republican Party look at you and they're like, oh, there's that crazy lady again talking about young people, like you just need to chill out? Or do they say, yeah, we get you, but we'll handle it when we need to?
So I think more and more people are realizing that the millennials are not going to just magically become conservative. Prophecy is coming true. That is something where the evidence has continued to mount, that no longer sounds like crazy doomsday prophesying, but rather is the reality that we're seeing in the data. However, very few people in politics think long term. And it makes sense to think short term. What's the next election? How do I put points on the board next November? How do I move the ball down the field as soon as possible? The idea that someone's going to spend a lot of time or effort thinking about the election of 2040 is in some ways a little silly, right? We don't know what the world's going to look like in 2040. So I think that's most of the pushback that I get, is that this is a very sort of slow-burning problem for the GOP, the idea that the next election is the one where the GOP's really going to pay for having let the millennial generation go. You know, I wouldn't even necessarily put my money on the idea that this next midterm is the one where Republicans will really pay for having let the millennial generation go. These trends are slow-burning, and so it may not be for a decade, at which point the world could look very different. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I still think that, you know, the things that we've seen in terms of millennial political attitudes over the last decade, you could have predicted by looking at some of the data and trends back 8 to 10 years ago. And so looking at it now still fills me with concern for the future of conservatism.
So I did some research on the Obama to non-voters, and they are, you know, disproportionately young and disproportionately people of color. And I definitely do think there is an extent to which the Democratic Party took these voters incredibly for granted.
Sean McElwee, co-founder of Data for Progress.
A lot of voters who were really energized by Obama didn't have a living memory of the Clinton era of politics. And when they were reintroduced to that era of politics in the 2016 election, they didn't like it. Bill Clinton signed into law a welfare reform bill. He signed into a law a crime bill. He signed into law, you know, financial deregulation. And I think that there was a real extent to which that turned off a lot of voters. And I think that the Democratic Party is just now beginning to reckon with the reality that sort of treating their base as disposable might not be the most effective way to get them to turn out in elections. We'll see if that starts to change. I think that the Democratic Party would be smart to run with candidates that can do the work and speak to their voters and run on the issues that excite people.
And so it's also not enough in the next election to say, look, you guys hate Trump, right? So come vote for Democrats. Because I've seen of younger voters, they dislike the president by a larger margin than any other age group. But is it enough to just say, look, you guys don't like him, so come vote for me?
I mean, it'll probably do a lot of work, for certain.
You're not unhappy about that as a motivating tool.
People get energized by things that make them mad. And, you know, like there is an extent to which things like child separation really will excite the sensibilities and frustrate a lot of Democratic voters. And I think that there are, you know, 435 mini experiments going out across the country. And it'll be really interesting and exciting to see how those shape up.
Kristen, what can you tell us about the difference between the millennials, those people who were born between 1981 and 1996, and the generation under them who are now coming out and voting? Some of them are just turning 18 this year. A lot of them, as we've seen, have taken to the streets, whether with Parkland students or in the women's marches. What do we know about non-millennial young people versus the millennial young people?
We don't have a ton of data yet about the political attitudes of Generation Z because most of Generation Z is still under the age of 18. So you've got a very narrow band that even can really be surveyed. But what we do know is demographic data about what this generation will look like. And what we know is that this will be a generation that is, I believe, only 50% white non-Hispanic, if not less than that. That this will be a generation where there is no one sort of racial or ethnic majority. And I think that is in the same way that you can't talk about the millennial vote without talking about the diversity of this generation. The fact that, Republicans actually fare reasonably well with white millennials. But of course, because Republicans do so poorly with millennials from communities of color, that is why you have this sort of yawning gulf between the GOP and the generation. I would expect you'd see even more of that given the even higher level of racial and ethnic diversity we see in Gen Z.
So is there a big difference between white millennial voters and white voters of other age groups in how they vote or see the parties?
Certainly. I mean, these factors are not necessarily independent of one another. Someone who is a younger white millennial will probably have views that are not quite as conservative as their white baby boomer grandparents on average. You know, individual cases may vary, of course. But these things are all related together. That's why, again, you know, you can, let's take gender, for instance. If you look at the millennial generation broadly, yes, Republicans are doing very poorly with millennials, but that's almost entirely driven by women as well. Millennial women breaking for the Democratic Party by about a 50-point margin, whereas
isn't that
millennial men,
than any other group, like any other women of any other generation, right? This is the biggest is millennial women.
That's right. So whether you're looking at age, whether you're looking at race, whether you're looking at gender, each of these does not necessarily exist in a vacuum. And so if you take any one group and you slice it by the other factor, you will find interesting patterns there. But the fact of the matter is that for the millennial generation, if Republicans want to pat themselves on the back because they're doing quite well with white millennial males, that is not even close to a majority of the millennial generation. That's like saying you got the most points in the first quarter of a football game, but you didn't win the game, so it doesn't matter. I think the Republican Party would do well, not just from a political perspective, but I suppose from a more optimistic, what do we want out of our government perspective, to be in touch with people of all races, of all demographic types, rather than just sort of writing off completely millennials from communities of color, young women saying, well, they're all out protesting us, we'll never win them. I think if Republicans are going to have a future for their ideas, they have to begin making inroads with the millennial generation. And that cannot just mean trying to run up the numbers with the subsets of millennials that are currently a bit more open to their message.
Okay, final question for you two. When we look back the day after the 2018 election, do you think that we will say millennials and younger voters were a key factor in the outcome of the election?
I mean, the thing that's important to note about young people is at this point, the floor is so incredibly low that any marginal gain would be quite significant. To put a number on that, according to the Census Bureau data, roughly 17% of people 18 to 24 voted in the 2014 midterm. So, you know, if we're seeing 33% of young people saying they're going to vote, and if 33% of young people voted, that would seem to be like a very small number, but it would actually be a quite dramatic improvement. And I think that could have a pretty big effect on the election.
My expectation is that the day after the election, the big story we're going to be talking about is gender, is the way that women will have played a massive role in shaping the politics of our country as a result of the midterm. But I think a sort of subset of that discussion will have to be millennial women. And so while I expect that gender, perhaps more than age, will be the headline, I do think that young women finding their political voice, getting engaged, is going to be, if not the main headline, a sub-headline coming out of this November.
There's a feeling out there among many young voters that the political system is so broken, so dysfunctional, it's not even worth it to participate. There's evidence this year, however, that this perception may be changing. We can see it on the ground in activism of the Road to Change students. And this week I met with a bunch of Democrats running for Congress. Almost all of them were under 40. Many of them were in their early 30s. Only two of them had ever run for elected office before. So will these young people single-handedly change politics? Of course not. But their mere presence in the process suggests they'll no longer be willing to be ignored. As always, I want to hear from you. You can send me a tweet at Amy E. Walter or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.